We're going to list all the gear that we're going to need to get through the end times. Number one on the list, absolutely number one on the list, is Jesus' own presence. And I don't mean that obviously physically, because Christ is seated at the right hand of the Father, but Jesus said that he was going to go away and send the Comforter. The Spirit is called the Spirit of Christ in several times in the New Testament. Jesus said just before he left with his disciples, the Spirit of truth, whom the world cannot receive because it neither sees him nor knows him. But you know him, for he dwells with you and will be in you. And I will not leave you orphans. I will come to you. Christ comes to us in the Spirit. That's what he's saying here, in the coming of the Spirit. And we receive Christ. We have the presence of Christ with us at all times. In fact, in the Great Commission, how did he end the Great Commission? Look, I am with you always, even unto the end of the age. Now, it's the end of the age that we've been talking about, is it not? It's the end. In fact, that phrase, the end of the age, is used another time in Matthew's gospel. It's in Matthew 24, when the disciples said, "What will be the signs of your coming and of the end of the age?" And Jesus gave them the signs that are going to appear at the end of the age, during that last seven-year period that we talked about. And so when Jesus sent his disciples out and said, "Look, I'm sending you out to make disciples of all nations, and I am with you always, even unto the end of the age," what he's saying is, not only am I going to be with you throughout this time that you're going out preaching the gospel, but all the way up, even through that final time, of trial and trouble. There are several passages in the Gospels and also in the Epistles that specifically deal with the end times and how we are to be prepared for those end times. The Sermon on the Mount is certainly one of those passages. Look at how the Sermon on the Mount ends in chapter 7, Matthew chapter 7. Jesus, in teaching his disciples, he gave them a whole series of commands and instructions on how to live as a Christian, how to be a follower of Christ, beginning in the Matthew 5, all the way through chapter 6, all the way through chapter 7, is all about what it means to be a follower of Christ. If you want to know what it means to be a follower of Christ, you need to saturate your mind with those three chapters, Matthew 5, 6, and 7. It's called the Sermon on the Mount. It's Jesus' first teaching to his followers on how they are to live as a Christian in light of his coming kingdom. But this is how he ends his sermon. Verse 24, "Therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rains descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock. Whoever hears these sayings of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand, and the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it fell, and great was its fall." I want you to notice a couple things from this passage of Scripture. The storm comes to all. The storm comes to all. He talks about those who were prepared for the storm and those who were ill-prepared for the storm. But the storm comes to all. And the storm is coming for all at the end of the age as well. Now, why does the one house stand and the other house not stand in the storm, in this parable? This is a parable.
One had the wrong foundation.
One was founded on a rock. One was not founded on a rock. Jesus, in the Bible in general, uses the rock as a metaphor many times. But that rock is who?
Christ.
It's Christ. It's in Deuteronomy 32, in Moses, the Song of Moses. In Deuteronomy 32, it talks about that rock that carried Israel all throughout their wilderness wanderings. Paul in 1 Corinthians 10 talks about that. And he said that rock was Christ. And here Christ is using the rock as a metaphor for himself and his teaching. That is all that he represented. If you build your life on the rock, that is on Christ and his teachings, and it's not just doing his commands, that's certainly a part of it. But if you study the Sermon on the Mount carefully, you'll see that it's not just a to-do list. The Sermon on the Mount is about a relationship with Christ, and it's about a new way of thinking and conducting ourselves in this world system that is contrary and opposed to Christ and to God. And so building your house on the rock is clearly talking about having your mind transformed to the thinking of Christ, to the example of Christ, the teachings of Christ, and living by that new way of thinking, which is outlined so clearly in here. Now, I'm not going to get into the Sermon on the Mount and the teachings of the Sermon on the Mount today. We are going to come back to that next week. We're not going to go through all of it. We did a whole series on it a couple of years ago. But I want to take some highlights from it, a couple of highlights from it that deal specifically with the end times later. And I'll do that next Sunday, Lord willing. For now, I just want you to pay attention to the application of it here to a rock, to building one's house upon a rock, and that when the storm comes, one group is going to survive, another group is going to fall flat. You've got to build your life on the teachings of Christ, or you're not going to make it through the end times successfully. That's very, very, very important. Jesus taught in parables. In fact, in Mark's gospel, it says, without a parable, he didn't even teach. He taught in parables. And one thing that I've noticed as I've been reading the Gospels more and more is that there are parables that we don't even realize are parables sometimes. You know, what was a typical parable of Jesus? He would tell a fictional story, right? He'd like make up a story about some incident, and then he would use that story to teach spiritual truths, right? But the story was about something that people encountered in their day-to-day lives, typically. But did you know that Jesus taught in parables in another way? And this is going to be something new to a lot of you. Did you know that many of the experiences that Jesus encountered with his disciples were intended to be parables? That is, Jesus walked his disciples through parables. I'll give you an illustration. The Mount of Transfiguration. Jesus said, there are some standing here today that won't see death until they see the kingdom of God come with power. And then the text says, after 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John, and he went up into a mountain. He was transfigured before them. His garments were shining. They saw Moses and Elijah. Jesus gave them a vision of the coming kingdom. He walked them through something. That experience didn't just happen for no reason. And there are a lot of things that happened that are recorded in the Gospels that were actually orchestrated by God so that Jesus could walk his disciples through them and teach them something. For example, the feeding of the 5,000. Do you think that was just some random thing that happened? The disciples wrote it down. Or was Jesus trying to teach them something from that situation? Here they are, they didn't bring enough food, and Jesus multiplies the bread. Was he teaching them something through that? He certainly was. Now, there are two instances in the Gospels, in Matthew, where we have a storm, and Jesus walks his disciples through a scenario where they are actually in danger, in the storm. He walked them through it as a parable to teach them some very important truths. And I want to look at both of those. Let's go to Matthew chapter 8. It's just the very next chapter. Right after he's teaching them about storms, here at the end of Matthew 7, when he tells them that to follow his command and his way of lifestyle is to build one's house on the rock, which will survive the storm. Right in the very next chapter, he takes them through a storm. He walks them through a storm. Let's look at Matthew 8, verse 18. And when Jesus saw the great multitudes about him, he gave a command to depart to the other side. That's the other side of the Sea of Galilee. Then a certain scribe came and said to him, Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go. And Jesus said to him, Foxes have holes, the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. Then another of his disciples said to him, Lord, let me first go bury my father. But Jesus said to him, Follow me and let the dead bury their own dead. Now when he had got into a boat, his disciples followed him. I want you to notice how many times we've run into the word followed already in this little section. And suddenly a great tempest arose on the sea, so that the boat was covered with the waves, but he was asleep. Then his disciples came to him and awoke him, saying, Lord, save us, we are perishing. But he said to them, Why are you fearful, O you of little faith? Then he arose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. So the men marveled, saying, Who can this be, that even the winds and the sea obey him? This is a parable. Did it really happen? Absolutely. It really happened. But Jesus is taking his disciples through this scenario. You know, this storm didn't just happen to come up at this time. God brought that storm for the disciples. Everything about this scenario is or ought to be interpreted as an allegory of Christ and us and the present age in which we live. Let's look at a couple of things. Look at verse 18. It says, when Jesus saw the great multitudes about him, he gave a command to depart to the other side. Let's try to interpret what this would mean in a parable, in the sense of a parable. You know, Jesus was preaching and teaching, and a lot of crowds came to hear him preach and teach. They came because of the free food on occasion. They came because he was healing people and they liked the show. Or some might even have come to be healed. Right? They wanted to see and hear him. But did the crowds commit to following him? No. They came to observe. They were spectators. But I want you to notice what Jesus did. Did he embrace that? In fact, there's an occasion where Jesus basically just got rid of them. Bluntly. Got rid of those people. Bluntly. But what did Jesus do? He separated himself from them. Isn't that what he did here? Look at verse 18. When Jesus saw the great multitudes about him, he gave command to depart to the other side. Him and his disciples, they get in a boat. And he says, look, let's get out of here. Now, what preacher does that? What preacher does that when he is preaching the message and crowds of people are coming to hear him preach? What preacher says, you know what, disciples, let's get out of here? What preacher does that? Well, the preacher who knows their hearts, I guess. This preacher did it. He did it. He said, you know what, let's leave. And they did. Look at what happened next. Then a certain scribe came and said to him, as I guess they're leaving, Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go. Here's a guy who's willing to make a verbal commitment to Jesus. But what does Jesus say to him? Look what he says. Foxes have holes, the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. In other words, are you sure? Are you sure you want to follow me? Because basically, I'm homeless. I'm homeless. You sure you want to follow me? That's what he was saying. There are Christians all over today, a lot of them in church, who are spectators, who come to hear what's being said, who come to look at what's going on. They don't make a commitment to really follow him, to do what Christ said, and that is be willing to forsake everything to follow him. The vast majority of people sitting in pews in churches across America today have not made that kind of a commitment to Christ. It's the truth. They have not. Verse 21. Then another of his disciples said, Lord, let me first go bury my father. Jesus said to him, follow me and let the dead bury their own dead. That is, don't be concerned about other things. Just follow me if you're going to follow me. Verse 23. Now when he got into the boat, his disciples followed him. There they are on the shore. Jesus is getting in the boat and his disciples follow him into the boat. Do you think that there were big, black, billowing clouds on the horizon when they got in the boat? Or do you think it was a nice, calm, sunny day and the water on the Sea of Galilee looked pretty good? I bet it was pretty calm because these guys, they had no qualms about it. They had already committed to following Christ. They follow him in the boat. You think they might have said, wait a minute, Jesus, those storm clouds look pretty bad. Maybe we should wait. They didn't say that because there were no storm clouds. There were no storm clouds. Verse 24, and suddenly a great tempest arose on the sea so that the boat was covered with the waves, but he was asleep. Then his disciples came to him and awoke him, saying, Lord, save us, we are perishing. So here we have, all of a sudden, we have these men who have decided to follow Christ. They've gotten in the boat with Christ. Here they are out on the Sea of Galilee. And all of a sudden, calamity. All of a sudden, they're in fear for their lives. Is that not what's going to face us as Christians in the coming years? Yeah. That's what's going to face us. You know, we came to Christ, we made a commitment to him, we decided we're going to follow him. I hope all of us are as committed as these disciples were, I hope. And right now, the water is pretty calm. It's a little bumpy, a little wavy, and we see a couple little clouds. But overall, things are pretty good. But all of a sudden, there's going to be a tempest. And we are going to be rocked to and fro, back and forth, to the point where we're in fear for our lives, just as these men were. And where was Christ? He was sawing logs down below deck. He wasn't worried at all. Now, let me ask you something. Should these guys have been worried? Should they have been fearful for their lives? From a logical point of view, they're in a tempest. All right, we've got that on the side of, yeah, they ought to be fearful. Why shouldn't they have been fearful? And look who's in the boat with him. I mean, if the boat goes down, who's going down? Jesus is going down, right? Is Jesus going down? No. Jesus is not going to drown. So if you think about it logically and not emotionally, if you're in the boat, you should have sat there in the storm and say, wait a minute. Do I really believe that Jesus is who he claimed to be? Yeah, I've seen all his miracles. I've seen all these things that he's done. I really believe it. Well, then, is he going to drown? Not likely. But you know what? We don't always think rationally, do we? And we don't always bring our faith to the forefront. Sometimes we let the circumstances around us overwhelm us, and we don't think straight. Isn't that right? I've done that. You guys have done that? Yeah. Yeah. The way that they reacted is perfectly natural. It's perfectly natural. It's perfectly normal. Now, Jesus says, O you of little faith, because obviously they had allowed their faith to become weak at that moment when they were looking at the storm instead of looking at who was in the boat with them, right? If they had been looking at Jesus and he is sleeping like a baby, they probably wouldn't have been quite as worried. But they weren't looking at Jesus sleeping as like a baby. They were looking at outside at the storm and the waves coming crashing over the boat. Verse 25, his disciples came to him and awoke him, saying, Lord, save us, we are perishing. But he said to them, why are you fearful, O you of little faith? Then he arose and he rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. So the men marveled, saying, who can this be that even the winds and the sea obey him? If you were one of these disciples, wouldn't you be glad you were in that boat? Because there were other boats on the Sea of Galilee that day. There are other boats that encountered that storm that day. Wouldn't you be glad that you were in that boat with Jesus as opposed to being in some other boat? And how can we apply that to ourselves? Look, this, as I said before, the storm is coming to all. Those who are prepared and those who are not prepared. The storm is coming to everyone. So if you're going to go through the storm, you're not going to bypass it unless you die before it happens. But if you're going to go through that storm, don't you want to be in that boat? Don't you want to be in that boat with Christ? And how do we get in that boat with Christ? Right now, in our day and age, how do we get in that boat with Jesus Christ? We make that commitment to be his disciple. We make that commitment. We choose to be his follower, his disciple. Starts with your baptism, and you continue to walk by faith, keeping Christ's commands, living the way he said, and putting him as your number one priority in the boat. Now, I want you to go to chapter 14 of Matthew. There's another incident of a storm. And again, I believe this incident was orchestrated by Christ himself for the purpose of teaching his disciples. I don't believe this was just incidental details that happened. I don't believe the storm was incidental. I don't believe any of the details in this story just happened at a random chance, and Jesus just wanted to show how great he was by walking on water. Matthew 14. Matthew 14, verse 22. Look, it starts the same way as the last one. Jesus making his disciples get into the boat. Isn't that what happened in the last one? He said, look, let's get in the boat. Let's get out of here. He left the crowds. Look at it again. Immediately, Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side. But something different about this one. While he sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. Jesus isn't in the boat with them, is he? This is the exact same scenario at the beginning. You've got multitudes of people coming to Jesus to hear what he has to say. But what does Jesus do? He dismisses them. He dismisses them. Just like he is going to do with the vast majority of church people. He's going to dismiss them. And you know why he's going to dismiss them? They haven't really made a commitment to follow him. That's why he's going to dismiss them. They haven't really made that commitment. They don't have a disciple's heart. There are other things they value more than Christ. So he dismisses them. But he made his disciples get in the boat. Verse 23. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up on a mountain by himself to pray. Isn't this like what happened at the end of Jesus' ministry? What did he do? He said, I have to go away. I have to go away. But when he said, I have to go away, and he went back and ascended to the right hand of the Father, he also said, I'll be with you always, even unto the end of the age. His physical presence wasn't with them this time. But was his presence with them ultimately? Yeah, not his physical body, but his presence was with them. Let's continue. The end of verse 23. Now when evening came, he was alone there. But the boat was now, that is at evening. The sun has gone down and it's dark and the storm comes up after dark. The storm comes up after dark. You know, Jesus talked about the darkness and the night as a metaphor for the end times. Did you know that? He talked about doing the works of him that sent me while it is day, because the night is coming when no one can work. That is, get busy with the message of the gospel while it is day, because night is coming and you won't be able to do it in the night. He used the night as a metaphor for end times. And here we have the disciples getting in the boat while it's daytime, and they're out going across the sea and it's getting dark. But not only does it get dark, which can be frightening when you're on the sea because you can't see where you're going, but also a storm comes up on the sea. Verse 25. Now in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them walking on the sea. Did you know the fourth watch is the last watch of the night? The night was divided into four watches, which would be 3 hours each, from sunset until dawn. So this is the last 3 hours before dawn is when Jesus went out. This is when the storm came up, and it's when Jesus then went out walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It is a ghost," and they cried out in fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer. It is I, do not be afraid." And Peter answered him, said, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." So he said, "Come." And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, "Lord, save me." There's the shortest prayer in the Bible, three words. Lord, save me. Three-word prayer works. If you have the intensity that Peter had, right? Peter wasn't just saying, "Thank you, Father, for our food." And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, "O you of little faith, why do you doubt?" And when they had got into the boat, the wind ceased. And those who were in the boat came and worshipped him, saying, truly you are the Son of God. This is a parable of the age we live in Christ's coming kingdom. Jesus sent the multitudes away. He's going to send multitudes, the majority of those who profess to be Christians, he's going to send them away. He commands his disciples to get in the boat. He's commanded us to follow him as his followers. The end time storm is coming just before dawn. Unlike the previous story where Jesus was in the boat, in this one, he wasn't apparently in the boat. But when they got into trouble, here he came, down from where he was praying on a mountain. He came down walking on the sea. What does that show? It shows his mastery over all of the calamity and the chaos that's going on or will be going on around us. Christ has mastery over it. Walking on the sea shows that it's all under his feet. It's all under his feet. Nothing can happen to us that he doesn't allow. He has complete power over it. Just like he was able to command the wind and the sea to stop in the previous story, here he is walking on top of water, something that's humanly impossible to do. And then finally, because of the miracle, it says that so many people worshipped him and cried out, truly you are the Son of God. And that's ultimately what's going to happen in Christ's kingdom when he finally arrives. Is that every knee is going to bow and every tongue is going to confess that he is Lord. So our number one piece of survival gear, if you want to call it that, number one for the end times is to make sure, absolutely sure, that you have Christ's presence with you in your boat. Absolutely sure. Now, how do we do that? First, we have to make sure we belong to him. We made a commitment to him. And that commitment is sealed at the moment that we are baptized. And we have to continue to follow him. And we have to have the mindset of a disciple. And what was that mindset of a disciple? To be willing to forsake everything and follow him. Jesus said, you know, I don't even have a home. If you're going to follow me, you might end up without a home. If you don't love me more than your father, your mother, your brother, your sister, your husband, your wife, your children, your lands, your possessions, you're not worthy to be my disciple. That's what Jesus said over and over again. Do you love him that much? Are you committed to him more than you are to your wife or your husband or your property or whatever it is? Are you? Because that's number one. The promises that we find in the Gospels, and there are plenty of promises in the Gospels, and God has promised to bring his true followers, Christ's true disciples, he has promised to bring them through the end times unscathed. But you got to make sure you're one of those disciples. You've got to make sure you're one of those disciples. Christ's presence depends on discipleship. That is, we are truly his disciple. And true discipleship depends on our willingness to forsake all to follow him. And following him means that we are being conformed to his character, which is what the Sermon on the Mount is all about. It's all about being conformed to his character. What I'm trying to impress upon you, because we're going to talk about the Sermon on the Mount next week, I'm trying to impress upon you how important it is that we take that sermon and we are conformed to that sermon in our lives, in every way. How important it is. Your survival in the end times depends on it. This is number one. I suggest that we take some time throughout the week and we read and we study those three chapters, Matthew 5, 6, and 7. Read them and study them and look. Jesus, you remember what Jesus, go back there for just 1 second and then I'm going to be done. Go back to Matthew 7. I want to point something out in verse 24. He said, therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them. And does them. See, being a spectator in the church pew isn't going to do it for you. It's not going to do it for you. If you don't take what you're hearing that Christ taught, if you don't take that and make that a part of you so that your life is just like that, then you're just kidding yourself. You're just kidding yourself. Everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does them. Two things. You've got to hear it and you've got to do it. Look at the verse 24. Everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does not do them. You hear it. And listen, like I said, there are people sitting in churches all over the country right now hearing Christ's commandments. But that's all that's happening. They're hearing it, but they're not doing it. They're not living that way. They're the ones, when the storm comes, they're going down. They're going down. You can't say you haven't been warned. Number one, make sure Christ is in your boat.